I grew up in northeastern Oklahoma in the Cherokee Nation. Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Tornado Alley,
green country. Yeah. And I went out to Pittsburgh for graduate school. So I was there at Carnegie Mellon for a long time. And then I followed my wife out here to Portland.
And the graduate school was studying?
Studying robotics. Yeah. So I went to undergrad in Tulsa at the University of Tulsa, which is a bike ride away from my house where I grew up, and studied computer science. And then after that was over, I decided I wanted to be able to make something in the world that could walk around and not be stuck inside of a computer screen. And so I went to the robotics PhD at Carnegie Mellon. So my research ended up being mostly artificial intelligence. I mean, robotics is a really an intersection type of field, you know. So a robot is really a solution to a problem. So depending on what your problem is, you could be building robots that go into space or go into the human body or explore dangerous places on the earth or under the water. You know, you never know. So for me, I was building intelligent environments that could help elderly people live safely and independently for as long as possible. My mom was a case manager. All the women in my family are pretty much nurses. And in Oklahoma, my mom would go out to rural Oklahoma and basically check on people and make sure that they're able to do the activities of daily living that you have to do in order to live independently and safely. And it's really hard because people lie. People sometimes don't know what they're capable of, and she can only get out there very rarely. And so I ended up actually building an application that would automatically monitor people and not do my mom's job, but would facilitate a case manager's job, especially whenever you have people that are in really rural areas and they don't get a lot of attention. But of course, I threw all that away and started writing books. So that's my thesis.
However, and that does appear in your books in several ways.
Sure. No, of course.
It's a basis.
And while I was at Carnegie Mellon, I got a big education in robotics, obviously. I mean, I did build robots. I mean, I built mobile robots. I built lots of AI applications, you know, artificial intelligence that could do various things. I helped build a robotic boat that could autonomously navigate in a riverway. So you end up working on a lot of different real robots, but you eventually have to pick the one thing. But on a higher level, you know, being a graduate student and having to be self-motivated actually really prepared me for being a writer later because you end up in this situation where, especially with me, I was kind of a loner because I had managed to get a grant myself. And so I just handed it over to my advisor, an awesome guy named Chris Atkinson, and he said, "Hey, that's terrific. You're like free labor, you know? Do whatever you want, Daniel." He used to tell me, "You're the world expert."
Nice.
And that's kind of humbling, you know, whenever you're 23 or 24.
Yeah.
And you think, well, I have narrowed what I study down to the point that I am the world expert because there's nobody else that's looking at it. But you have to self-motivate, you know? So you end up with a situation where there's nobody telling you to go to work. The deadlines are maybe months or years out. And so you just have to get up and you have to work with no end in sight, you know, and no real awareness of how much closer you're getting to the finish line every day. And that's really...
Sounds like a novel.
Writing a novel. That's what it's all about. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's weird. You figure out all these different levers that are going to motivate you, you know.
Yeah.
And on one hand, I keep meticulous track of my progress. Always, I outline everything and I make sure I know exactly how far I am because that way I can look at a spreadsheet and go, all right, you know, like I did all those little X's mean I did something. I keep a different file every day. I copy and paste a new file with a different version number so I can always go back because sometimes you branch off. It's like saving your game in a video game. Sometimes you branch off when you're writing and you do a bunch of stuff you don't like. And it's fun to be able to back it up to where the branch happened and then maybe steal a bunch of old stuff.
Yeah.
You know, in grad school, I also would feel guilty. There was a strong sense of guilt if I didn't do it. And there's also a strong competition with your peers. You know, you're always competing. Yeah. And so, you know, competition, guilt, just sheer falling into the pattern of it, you know, that's the kind of thing that got me through it. And writing those grant proposals as a scientist is very similar to writing a book proposal later. So it was amazing, actually. I mean, obviously, the stuff I was writing in grad school was very prescriptive. You know, you have to adhere to the rules. You write your abstract, mm-hmm. then your introduction. You know,
yeah.
it's not like creative writing, you know, or fiction at all, obviously. You're doing it wrong if you're a scientist and you're writing fiction.
So you were getting ready to be a writer. What's your background as a kid and growing up with reading, writing, arithmetic? Actually, skipped arithmetic.
You know, as a kid, I was a reader. I mean, I read voraciously at all times. My family was always really annoyed with me. I always had a book. Mm-hmm. No matter where we were at, it was always, they were hitting me on the shoulder going, look at that. You know, like we're on a family trip to Mount Rushmore.
Yeah.
I'm not looking, I'm just looking at the
right.
book. And every day I'd go into class, all the kids would be talking to each other. I'd be sitting there with the book, you know, I mean, and at that time, when you're young, your brain is better. You know, I could just pick up a book and be in it, you know, like that.
Yeah.
And I could read it for 5 minutes or for an hour or for all day. I used to remember reading and then I'd get up because the sun would have moved, you know, scooted over and sat back down. And for me, I remember thinking that reading was a form of time travel because I would disappear and then time would go by and I'd come back out and it would be later. And so I used to hate having to walk home from the bus stop because it was like a mile or two and it took too long and I was annoyed by it. And so I would read while I would walk to try to time travel home, you know, and get home faster. But luckily I had my dad feeding me books. So he would take me to 3B's used bookstore every weekend in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And I would trade out all my other books for new books, well, used books,
yeah.
Half price, you know, and then my dad would kind of fill in the rest of it and I would walk out with more books. And so, you know, I just read whatever was on the shelf. You know?
Did your parents collect books, keep books?
No, they didn't really have very many books around. They did. I mean, we had books, but we had like Funk and Wagnalls,
right.
you know, encyclopedias.
Right.
My dad had a little trove of science fiction in his office. And those were my formative books, and they were chosen so randomly that it's like, you know what I mean? It's just like, it's hilarious now for me to think about how important those books were to me and how completely randomly thrown together they were from his perspective. You know, they just happened to be some paperbacks that were sitting around.
Do you remember anything particular, any particular
sure.
book?
Right? Yeah, well, I mean, my favorite book of all time is still just a random book my dad had called Sea of Glass by Barry Longyear. So Barry Longyear wrote Enemy Mine, which was turned into a movie with, you know, in the 90s or something. It's a great movie, actually.
Yeah.
But Sea of Glass is about this future where a big computer is basically making all the decisions for society in order to maximize efficiency. And what's happening is half of the world is under the guidance of this benevolent machine. And the other half of the world is basically out of control. They're overpopulating. It's a book from the 70s, so everyone's worried about overpopulation at the time. What's interesting is this machine's job is to watch people, form models of their behavior, and then predict what they're going to do. And I realized halfway through grad school that that was my thesis topic.
Yeah.
I mean, and I was blown away because I didn't realize it, you know.
Trajectory
that I was doing this thing
PhD.
That I read when I was 10, you know, and had thought about a lot because I reread that book every year, year after year, including in grad school, you know, including now I sometimes reread it.
Yeah.
I have called Barry Longyear and personally thanked him.
Well, that's neat.
Yeah. Yeah. You know,
I mean, so you have this background with books, used books,
science fiction, short stories, in particular short stories, like the pulps.
That's a big jump to writing.
Yeah.
Did you write short stories or?
Yeah, in high school. In high school, I was obsessed with writing short stories. So I thought I would be a science fiction writer in high school. So, you know, I was learning how to program computers. I was doing stuff like that. But, I mean, in my mind, the coolest possible thing that you could do would be a science fiction writer. I knew I wanted to be a scientist or a scientist. I mean, as a kid, when I was 5, I imagined myself in a lab coat and.
Yeah.
You know, and I would do experiments around the house. I mean, that's what I was interested in. And also, I grew up in I grew up in the Bible Belt, and there was a lot of proselytizing all the time. And, and I very quickly dug in my heels early on and decided, I can remember quizzing my Sunday school teacher about basically the flight dynamics of an angel. Like, how would a human being have wings that could support, you, and like, wouldn't you have to have really big shoulder muscles? And and nobody wants to hear that, right? Nobody wants to have to explain that you can't. And so, like, but I remember digging my heels in, and they were like, no, just basically take it on faith, which is, you know, what you have to do. And and I remember just even at that age, just saying, well, no, that just doesn't sound right. I'm not into that.
I love it.
So it was really, but of course my little brother is, you know, I have lots of people in my family that are religious. I don't have anything against it, but it's just that that's kind of the direction I went early. And so I had really great teachers in high school. That I had an English teacher, Paul Dykes. He would read my short stories that I was writing, and he would correct them without judging them for how awful they might be. He would just fix them up, you know,
have you grammatically. Kept any of those stories?
Sure. Yeah.
You did
me. Oh, it's all goofy shit. It's all
of course.
It's a guy with a. So what I loved about short stories was that they were like mouse traps. You know, I didn't care about the writing. I didn't care about the flowery prose.
Right.
None of that. I was always very. I've gotten to be a little bit more of an artist over the years now as an adult. But as a kid, I wasn't like that. I was like a laser beam. I said, I don't care about your flowery BS. You just give me the plot. And it's either good and it works. And at the end, I literally get goosebumps or I cry or it doesn't work.
Yeah.
You know, and no amount of beautiful writing is going to change that. And so I really liked Clark. You know, I felt like he's terrible at like describing stuff. But like the beauty and the simplicity of his stories and how they would snap at the end, because those short stories often have that Twilight Zone kind of twist.
Yeah.
And that's what I craved was that twist. I wanted to get to the end and, you know,
Twilight
and that's
Zone.
The satisfaction. So, you know, so that's what I sought to emulate. I tried to make these mousetrap stories where there'd be a great twist at the end, you know?
Yeah.
And you know, my stories sort of, you could see that I was trying to do it. I still have them, and they're kind of, you know, they're awful. They were all got rejected, too. So they were all rejected from the magazine of fantasy and science fiction and so forth. The little rejection slips and everything that I used to get. See, I'm never motivated by that. I don't feel like people are out to get me. I feel like I just need to make it better.
Yeah, you're okay.
You know, like, I know that there are all these great stories of people that they wrote it, that's the way it is, they go out with it, 100 people hate it, they're all stupid, 101 swallows that pill.
Yeah.
I think most of those stories are bullshit. I think what really happens is 101 sees how to make what they've got into something great, and it helps the author make that conversion. But it's so easy to forget that part.
That's good.
Where you take what your raw material and then you basically take it from the minor leagues to the major leagues.
Yeah.
And you usually need another person to help you do that.
Yeah.
And it's easy to forget that person.
Yeah.
You know, because we're all so brilliant. But I'm sure that that's happened, but you know, it's just in my mind I see it as very rare. As soon as all those rejection slips came in and I went to college, you know, I forgot about writing fiction.
Uh-huh.
I took the honors course, thank God, and I had to study English in college. Otherwise, in computer science, I would have never had. They made us do one public speaking course, which was awful. Doing the public speaking course with all the other computer science majors is rough. Yeah. Oh, it's just people are up there just shaking and sweating. And
doing PowerPoints. Oh, God.
Yeah, and then they're knocking their stuff over. And yeah, no, this is, you know, I went to school. I graduated undergrad in 2000. So, I mean, this is like when the internet was sort of starting.
Yeah.
So PowerPoint wasn't really a thing even.
Right.
It was. Actually, I gave a presentation on why are we learning how to do presentations with paper. Whenever PowerPoint was the way to go. But anyway, I was trying to get published. I was trying to get published, though, in journals and trying to get published in conferences and things. And so I did get published that way lots.
Yeah.
And then I guess whenever I got out of... whenever I was finishing up school, I just wrote a book. So the first thing I ever got published in popular press was How to Survive a Robot Uprising.
Right.
Yeah, it would have been. So... I didn't ever write a short story until years later after I'd written 4 or 5 little books, you know. Because from my perspective, I saw no reason to write short stories. Because you don't get any money. You don't get any acclaim, really. I mean,
right.
You can. And there are people who, I mean, obviously, and you can change a little kid's life. You know, I know that.
Yeah.
But relative to writing for a living, like if I'm going to sit down and spend 2 solid weeks writing a short story... for $50, that's not like how I'm going to pay my mortgage, right?
Yeah.
So, because that's all I was doing is writing. So, you know, I wrote How to Survive a Robot Uprising as a joke because I was in grad school. I had all these robotics professors around me, and I was able to ask them, how would you survive? What would you do if yours attacked them? And Carnegie Mellon, the Robotics Institute, is huge. I mean, there's people doing autonomous vehicles, and there's a, I love, there's a sign that says planetary robotics that way. You know? It's like automotive robotics that way. And it's amazing. You walk in and you see that, and it's like, oh, wow, you know, that's for real. That's not some, this isn't science fiction. There's really a sign. Go that way, you will really find a rover. So I asked everybody, and the way I think I got into it was really, I was just the right person to write that book. It was a good title. And it was like, I had a PhD in robotics. It was like, who else is going to write that? And it was funny, you know? So I got really lucky in that respect, you know, that I was able to kind of come back around to my original interest. And what I found throughout graduate school is I suck at math. I was killing myself. I mean, I was beating my head against the wall, and I'm good at writing.
Yeah.
Like, I've always just, that's the thing, you know, sometimes you try a lot of things in your life, and you're better at some things than you are at others. And reading and writing, man, that was my thing. That was always my thing. And I studied nothing but statistics for like 6 years, just killed myself. And I was around people who had the same knack I have for reading and writing, but for numbers.
Yes.
And you'd watch them and see how fast they would pick it up, and you just think,
there's this bulge, I'm going to be at home for 8 more hours. Math.
Yeah.
And it doesn't on me either. And
there's some people that are just good at everything. I hate those people. They're terrible.
They don't count.
But,
So you remember the first time you got an acceptance letter for a piece of your...
No, I remember the first time I got an agent, you know? I remember the first time I had my query letter responded to from a publisher. You know, these are all the little milestones that are, you know, required to be a writer.
Right.
So I had a friend who told me, hey, I have a friend who's an editor at some publishing house. You should send him your query letter. So I was like, okay. So I sent that to him, and the guy wrote me back. His name is Mark Chait. And he said, basically, you're an idiot. Do not contact editors directly. I don't want this. Here are three agents, just their names, that I know of who've tried to sell me stuff like this, or who have successfully sold stuff like this.
Well, and that's nice.
Yeah. I mean, that was it. He made it for me. You know, it was amazing because I was able to target three people. They all responded to the query letter because, again, it was like, actually, one of the people on his list, the guy only accepted written mail, like snail mail.
Yeah.
And I was like, no, we're not going to get along. If you don't accept email and it's like 2000, you know, 2002, maybe you should just stick with your current authors. So I ended up with my agent, Lori Fox, and she's like, her personality she's just so excited, you know, and earnest. And so immediately I was just buoyed by her, and I sent her my proposal, and she was like, oh, wow, that's really great. Here's a real proposal. And I saw that, and I was like, oh, you know, and she just told me the deal, and I was able to figure out how to get out there and try to sell a book. But I remember these moments, you know. I remember the moment that I got a phone call from my film manager saying that Paramount had bought the rights to Robot Uprising. And how much money they bought it for. And I remember I was at an Ethiopian restaurant in Pittsburgh, pacing up and down the street outside, talking to this guy who I didn't even know worked for me. He's a sub agent.
Yeah.
So he just called me, and I was like 24, and he was like, do you want lots of money? And I was like, and that's when it hit me that I could write for a living. And for me, I don't know, maybe it's probably in my upbringing. I'm just somewhat mercenary. I was never an artist. I never, you know, I was always pretty practical about making money. And so I always thought, well, I couldn't really do that because I couldn't really make that much money. And as a roboticist with a PhD coming out of school, you'll make a certain amount of money. And I thought, if I can do that with books, then I can rationalize doing this for a living. And with that movie type of stuff, I was able to, you know, get close and then stick with it long enough to transition into writing fiction, because that didn't happen until Robopocalypse.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. And that was in 2009 was when I sold Robopocalypse.
Brilliant book.
Thank you.
Well written. Just the construction.
Oh, man.
The engineered construction of it.
Robogenesis is so much better. You can always see when you're learning, you know?
Yeah.
You can always look back at anything you wrote and just hate it. So I'm sure I'll hate Robogenesis, but I gotta have a few years to ideally get better at writing before I do.
That's neat. Your habits for writing. Do you have a particular time of the day, night,
mm-hmm.
place, habit?
So every time you sit down to write, you're not sure if you're going to be able to do it again. Because you don't know how you do it, and it's a magic trick.
Yeah.
And you just hope that the magic happens, right?
A
and there's nothing
trick.
You can do about it.
Yeah.
And so I think that's why writing, the act of writing, every day, especially when your career depends on it, you know, where you can't just go to work and say, oh, I forgot how to work the drill press today, you know, boss. Sorry, I'm going to go fishing all day. You can't do that. And so I think it spawns all this superstitious behavior because people don't understand how they do it. And so they build up all of the ritualistic behavior around it, just like with sports. You know, I don't understand how my sports teams win, so I'm just going to make sure I wear the right socks.
Right.
I actually, being kind of logical, avoid all of that crap. Except what I've realized now is I've avoided it to the extent that I've doubled back on it, and now I am superstitious about not being superstitious. So, like, one day, one of the worst days ever, I chose my favorite underwear to go to a job interview, and I proceeded to have, I would say, the most embarrassing, humiliating, gut-wrenchingly, like, soul-searchingly, shockingly terrible interactions with human beings that I adored and really valued their opinions. You know, it was crushing. I had a crushing day, and I swore I would always just wear whatever pair of underwear were on top. And now I open the drawer and I go, man, I gotta take the ones off the top. But now I realize I've ritualized that behavior.
Yeah.
What are you gonna do, right? You're a human being.
A life form. All life forms develop those patterns.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I know that better than most because I wrote a thesis on, and believe me, people are incredibly predictable.
Yeah.
I have lots of examples that I noticed over the years, but people dry off with a towel, like, in the same order. Like, you do the same things at the same time on the same day. For me, I'm also that way with writing. So I get up at the same time. My kids help me with that now.
Yeah.
I'm at the same coffee shop drinking the same drink, ideally at the same table if I can be. And everything's the same. And for me, that's just, it is magic that happens. I know that yesterday it happened under these conditions. Let's just maintain those conditions.
Right.
Let's not change too many variables.
Right.
I can't write while I'm on a book tour, for instance. I just can't do it. You know, I can't really write a novel, you know, like on an airplane or anything. So I have to have that day in, day out. It's very boring. I mean, I write from 9 to 11 are my prime time, getting it all out there, anywhere from 500 to 2,000 words, sometimes more, very rarely. It's very modest, you know, you just do it every day.
Yeah.
Usually on the weekends too, but not always.
You clearly write with what, a cuneiform script on clay tablets?
Just a boring laptop, you know. It's important that I walk, though, before and after. I walk to the coffee shop, you know, so that's about 3/4 of a mile, so it's about 10 minutes or something of walking and listening to music and thinking.
Do you ever take notes on ideas that come to mind?
Yeah, just on my phone.
Okay.
Little notepad. Of course. I mean, yeah, you have to take notes all the time. I mean, who doesn't do that? And now I've ended up writing a lot of different things. So I've written these novels, but I've also now been doing world building for video games. I've written screenplays.
Yeah.
I've written, now I'm writing for DC Comics. And it's interesting. You internalize this, just how a story should go, and then it kind of comes out in all these different formats, you know, depending on what your media is.
You are 1 foot into the future anyway, just by virtue of your profession, thinking and views of the world. Do you have a guess or a sense of where we're going with this writing, storytelling, book publishing, whatever it might be?
Well, I mean, human beings communicate through story. I mean, that's it. Period. So anything that we interact with, any kind of technology that shows up, we're going to use it to tell each other stories. I had a friend recently who went through law school and he became a defense attorney. And he told me something that blew me away. It seems obvious in retrospect, but I was asking him, you know, how do you pick a jury? And how do you convince this jury that, you know, your person is innocent and all this? And I was thinking it was like logic, you know, you pick the smartest people, yeah. you tell them the facts, you know, they work it out.
Yeah.
And no, absolutely not. It's all about the story. It's about the emotion. You doesn't choose this. If you have a PhD, you don't get picked on them. They don't pick the people they think are smart. They pick the people they think are emotional, because those levers are how we move each other around in the world, and it's how we interact. And so, you know, knowing that seems very illogical to me. It seems very much like that's more Captain Kirk than Spock, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, being like a technology type person, but also a storyteller, you always have to remember that. You know, you have to remember that from the beginning. It's not about the medium. It's not about any new technology. It's not about the special effects that you have available. You know, you can see how people they lose track of what the heart of a story really is, because there's so much around it now, and there's so much, and it's also tough to figure out how to tell a story through a brand new piece of technology, right? So for instance, like I'm working on a really fun project, which is challenging but fascinating, where it's basically interactive fiction. So I grew up playing Zork, right? It was like a really simple computer game where you type in, tell it where to go, and it just gives you text, and the guy describes the room or whatever. You could say, look around, and the guy will tell you what the room looks like.
Right.
Pick this up, try this on that, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, what's fascinating about that is, you know, no matter what the technology is, whether it's a movie or a book or however you're conveying the story, it's the human brain that's putting the story together and synthesizing this thing into an experience. And so Zork is just as powerful as a movie. You know, whenever you wake up from reading a book, you just saw a movie in your head, and in a lot of ways it might have been better than the special effects that are in a movie. The lips never move funny, you know, on the CG characters in my mind, right?
Yeah.
So this interactive fiction idea is the idea that you can, it's an iPhone app, you know, and the idea is that you get a Mayday call from a character who's asking you to help them through a situation, and it uses speech recognition, so you actually talk to the person. It's a limited set of commands that you can give, but you're literally like talking to a person who is acting on their own. They don't always do what you say. Sometimes they'll get scared and run away. I mean, you know, you're trying to guide them through this situation, and you ask them to describe something, and they describe it, and the entire thing takes place, the entire interaction and story is told over a radio connection with your mind filling in all of the details. So this guy's describing what he's seeing. There's actually a great movie that really inspired me on this project called Pontypool, and it's a zombie horror movie that takes place entirely in a radio station, and they're taking calls from people in the city, and hearing someone just describe what happens when another person just bites a person's face off or something is so horrifying, you know, that it's just, it blows your mind. It's much scarier than actually watching it.
Yes.
How many times have I seen a pack of zombies jump on a guy and they always go, look at the camera, and they've always got it's almost like whatever, you know, but hearing someone describe it is your brain fills it in, and it's amazingly horrifying.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I drew a lot of inspiration from that, and this game is actually almost finished. I mean, I'm going to be going out with it in the next 3 months. We'll see how it does, you know.
Cool.
But I made a lot of decisions with this game that were a result of the medium on which it was delivered, which is an iPhone. I chose to make the game speech recognition so that the player had to be alone You know, a book, you can't drive a car and read a book at the same time, you know. Like, depending on how you're getting your story given to you, there are different constraints. A movie, you gotta go sit still. You know, if it's an audiobook, you can run around. Like, you know, there's all these different sort of setups, you know. And and you gotta keep that in mind whenever you're writing, ideally, for whatever medium you're writing in. And so, for this, I decided intentionally, I said, let's make it speech rec. Let's make the person have to be alone, ideally, in a nice, quiet, dark place. So let's make it scary.
Nice.
I mean, you know, let's make it creepy. We use a lot of audio in order to set the mood and everything. And it's been, I mean, amazingly fun. Of course, I had to have a team of programmers. So it's a little different than just writing a novel.
The people who did study math in school.
People who kept going. You know, I got a programming book and I said, let's do this, Daniel. Let's do it, Wilson. And I sat down and I went through the iOS programming. And at the end of it, I was like, no. I'm just going to cough up a little bit of money and have somebody program this for me.
You must have a lot of young writers or people who want to be writers knocking on your door, emailing you, saying, how do I get started? What do you think? Will you read this? Will you write my... My favorite one is, I have the best idea for a great book. Will
you write
it for me?
Yeah, I get those sometimes.
Okay, but for serious young writers or prospective writers, do you have advice about what route they should take, what they should do?
Well, I mean, there's all the sort of businessy stuff, like the query letter, the agent, you know, blah, blah, blah. Or you can do the self-publishing thing, you know. I mean, I don't know about that route, but obviously it's worked out for some people.
Yeah.
And I feel like you can just look all that stuff up. But I think, you know, I stumbled into this backwards, like a lot of people do. And there's a reason that people fall into this job backwards. People who are able to, you know, keep doing it, they fall in backwards. And they're not looking for it, and it's because those are the people who are actually not trying to hit some target. You know, you're not, I just say, only write what you're really interested in. If you're writing part of anything and you think that it's boring or it's filler just to get to another place, get it out of there.
Mm-hmm.
Forget it, you know. Sure. Just dessert, you know, just the good stuff.
Yeah.
Never any of the boring shit in between. If you don't like it, nobody else will. And, you know, for me, I love robots and technology. I'm a dork. I have always loved robots and technology. Yeah. I studied it for real. I read all about it in science fiction. I don't really care which one I'm doing. And that gives it a certain veracity. I'm not kidding, right?
Yeah.
I didn't, like, go to a workshop and say the next hot thing is robots, and so I'm going to go do this. There's no faking it, you know?
Yeah.
And that, I think, no faking it, that hits on both sides of the equation. It hits on the side of the equation when you're actually having to get up and write every day and do something that, you know, this also goes for being in grad school.
Right.
You never choose a research topic that you don't genuinely love or are interested in, because you're just going to have to do it every day for years and years. And why in God's name would you do that to yourself, right? And then on the other side of it, if you really enjoyed it, it shows, you know, people can tell. The thing with robots and AI especially is people anthropomorphize it, because we're the only intelligent walking, talking entities around that we've ever...
That we know of.
And we're all designed to interact with each other. I mean, we got no choice. We're on the rails here in terms of how we interact. And so it's so hard for us to step outside and look at ourselves and see, okay, here's the objective experience, which is rubbing meat around over some bone and some sound waves coming out, right? And then here's the emotional layer that our prefrontal, like, throws over that, you know, and here's the, you know, the empathetic layer. And there's all these layers of humanness that we're swimming around at the bottom of this fog, you know, and objectivity is way up there. And so you have to swim out of that and say, okay, what is the actual stimulus? And then say, if I'm building a new intelligence that's not human, that maybe doesn't have emotions or only understands emotions abstractly from the ground up, how does that entity see this stimulus? And I mean, that's like a real mental challenge to do that. And obviously we don't have to do that. There's no reason for us to do that. We're all human beings here. It's, you know, we don't all need to learn how to sort of Asperger size ourselves in order to, you know, to see the mechanics of all that, you know. Yeah. But it really helps me to be able to do that, writing robots and AI.
Yeah.
To have seen just how hard it is to build them from the ground up and how little they understand and how bizarre and alien they can be.
Yeah. You've just been awesome.
Thanks.
You've been awesome. It's just been me. You've hit all the main things I can think of. Is there anything you'd like to just add? This is your free moment to proselytize.
Oh. Well, I specifically don't proselytize. There's been enough of that for me.
You're not going to warn us about the coming robot revolution? You're not going to warn me?
No. The longer you spend...
My computer on my truck?
have seen no warning signs of the robopocalypse. And you know, the longer you spend studying robotics, I think the less afraid you are of robots, just because you see how hard it is to build them and make them do anything, much less, you know, track down and kill wily mammals like ourselves. So no, I don't have any warnings about the
robopocalypse. Darn it, I was hoping.
But, you know, what I would say is it's interesting to balance your right brain and your left brain, you know, whenever you're doing this. And for me, that's a challenge because I'm writing about science fiction and technology and then also emotional characters and relationships. And I would say, you know, always start always with the characters and the relationships and the emotions. And then, only then, especially if you're doing science fiction, or fantasy even, do you bring in all of the world building and the extra layers. And you just have to remember, your job is not to predict the future. Your job is to facilitate the story that you're telling. And so building a consistent world, a consistent technological world that obeys its own rules, and you know, just make sure that you're not building it for its own sake. It should be a scaffolding that is helping to exaggerate the fundamental drama of your characters. And so that's my advice to science fiction writers, anyway.
Nice. Dan, this has been remarkable. I really, really want to thank you.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Anytime.
And we wish you all the best with the new book and all that's coming ahead. It's awesome.
Thank you.
Thank you.